Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley. Hope you're doing well this Wednesday. It's the middle of the week. The crocus of freedom is poking through the snow, or whatever it is. Anyway, the sun is out, which is much nicer. Coming up, we've got PMQs unpacked. Tim Shipman and I pause the action live from the House of Commons as Boris Johnson and Keir Starmer clash over the dispatch box. But first, it's Wednesday, so our columnist panel is, of course, Camp Alice. It's John Kampfner and Alice Thompson. Every so often, there's one of these stories which sort of blows up, and people keep tweeting me saying, "Why aren't you talking about this?" And I say, we talk about it almost every day, but it is one of those stories which there's this sort of sense of it not getting quite enough coverage, certainly south of the border. Is what on earth is going on in the SNP? It's been quite the sort of turbulent few days with Alex Salmond now not giving evidence to the inquiry into how the Scottish Government handled complaints against him. He was due to give evidence today. But a Scottish Parliament spokesperson said that the former First Minister had said he will not be attending. It comes after the Parliament withdrew and then republished a redacted version of his submission to the inquiry. It's all getting very complicated. It's essentially sort of almost civil war in the SNP. Why does this matter, John, beyond the sort of the narrow question of Alex Salmond wanting, in his eyes anyway, to get some sort of justice?
And what people are saying publicly, and what they're allowed to say publicly, is only a tiny fraction, Matt, of what they're saying behind the scenes, the conspiracies, the conspiracy theories, whether the prosecutor's in hock with the First Minister and who's doing what. I mean, Scottish politics, even at the best of times, and I go back to the old days of Gordon Brown versus Robin Cook. I mean, Scottish politics has always been visceral and internecine, and this is really, really vicious. And it matters because the Scottish elections are coming up in May. I haven't seen any most recent opinion polls. Maybe you guys have, but I mean, the SNP was flying incredibly high, looking pretty much to sweep the board, partly because Labour have gone from being uber powerful to being nowhere in Scotland and the Tories doing not much. So it was going to be an SNP landslide. That was going to put a huge amount of pressure on Westminster, on London, on Boris Johnson to agree to a second Indy ref, which he was absolutely hell-bent on refusing. And the big question is, therefore, is the SNP going to be harmed by it?
And I think you're right. The SNP are still ahead, although slightly dipping, I think, in the polls. Alice, to people who are not in Scotland, this matters because of the knock-on effect of what might happen, you know, if the SNP were badly damaged in the polls. Nicola Sturgeon doesn't get her majority, her argument for an independence referendum, you know, that could actually decide the future of the union, this what seems like a very complicated row involving Alex Salmond.
It is incredibly complicated, but very important. I mean, I'm half Scottish, which is why I don't have P in my Thompson, bizarrely. It's the Scottish spelling, but I find it's a very common name up in Scotland, talking to my cousins up there who are very political action, quite involved. I think it's extraordinary because it's this vicious fight between two people who were extremely close. I mean, if you look at Nicola Sturgeon was Salmond's protege for years. He actually got her into the position and then she did better than he did. So it's much less straightforward than you think. And she really is now the Queen of Scots. In the last year, her personal ratings have just soared with COVID and how she has dealt with it. And regardless of how else she's doing in Scotland, people feel that she did a very, very good job with COVID. And so there's this bizarre situation where the person who really put her there is now out to get her and she's out to get him. And it's an extremely personal fight. And I feel very sorry for the women who are caught up in it, who are anonymous, but, you know, are known to many people and have been, you know, viciously accused online. And I think you'd now feel that if you felt that you were a victim in any sort of sexual assault case, you wouldn't come forward now, because, I mean, it's an absolute nightmare, I think, for them. And these two protagonists are fighting it out together. And there's a lot of collateral damage for other people involved really now.
It is absolutely extraordinary. It's one of those things that the Scottish Conservatives are now trying to sort of weaponise, if you like. Normally they go around saying, oh, it's the SNP who are obsessed with constitutional things. Adam Tomkins, who is a Conservative MSP, is also a Professor of Law at the University of Glasgow. He was absolutely furious about the way that the Scottish Parliament had sort of intervened in this, saying the history of parliaments in this country is we stand up to the crown, but not today. Today, a parliament folded. That's not a farce. It's a tragedy and it's a shameful historic error. And so it just feels like it's going to get even more and more political over the coming days. Do we think that actually most people are going to follow all of this? In fact, I've just looked up the poll. So the last time there was a polling, some polling in Scotland was on the 9th of February. And actually, the SNP were up a little bit. They're still on, 54? I mean, well over 50% in the polls. Do you think, John, there's a risk that, that people who don't like the SNP, don't like the idea of independence, might still yet get a shock? That they might. It's a bit of wishful thinking for thinking this you know, domestic that's being played out of the SNP might not actually have much impact on voters.
Well, I mean, the issue, I suppose, if you're a Scottish voter, is who else would you vote for? The Lib Dems pick up bits and bobs normally in the Highlands and the Islands and not much else. The Tories have bits and bobs usually in the Borders and in Tayside and the sort of the posher, more rural parts of Scotland. But it used to be Labour in Glasgow, the big cities, that was absolutely the machine. And Labour UK-wide used to be absolutely dominated by Scots and they were absolutely the dominant machine party in Scotland. Now they are absolutely nowhere. They've just got rid of yet another Labour leader. So even if you thought, I'm not interested in, or I've got sort of disdain for the domestic going on between Sturgeon and Salmond, where else do you go?
I suppose that's the thing. Yeah, you're right. I was just looking. The Labour Party in Scotland hasn't been over 20% for the constituency vote anyway, because obviously there's the two votes, constituency and then the list vote. Haven't been over 20% since April last year. It's all been bouncing around up and down. And the Tories have actually, you know, come down quite a bit. They were on sort of mid-20s. They're now on low 20s. And nobody, apart from Ruth Davidson, who is strangely still currently leading the Tories in the Scottish Parliament, but not actually the Scottish leader, nobody seems to be able to lay a glove on Nicola Sturgeon. It'll be fascinating to see if the one person who ends up doing her in is, in fact, Alex Salmond, rather than anyone from any other political party. Let's move on, because there's been some breaking news this morning. On the NHS is now being advised to vaccinate those on the GP Learning Disability Register. This the Joint Committee on the Vaccination and Immunisation, the JCVI, has now advised the government and the NHS to invite more people with learning difficulties to receive their COVID-19 vaccines. And you've written about this already. Maybe it's a result of your column, Alice, because you've written about this in the Times today.
I don't think so.
Alice's column moves politics, it moves markets.
I know. Exactly right. Exactly. What's interesting, so just talking about Scotland, is that Nicola Sturgeon has already done this. So she put all people with a learning disability onto the register much faster, as did Germany. So it's interesting that she has been one step ahead in this way from Britain, because from England, because in England we didn't put people who had learning disabilities, unless they were very severe, onto the register, and we failed to recognise just how many people with learning disabilities were dying compared to the general population.
And obviously, the story's sort of made the headlines in the last few days because of Joe Wiley, Radio 2 DJ, who was shocked, I think it's fair to say, to discover that although she's fit, she does triathlons and that sort of thing, she was shocked to discover that she was going to get the jab before her sister Frances, who's got a rare genetic disorder and diabetes, and was actually ended up briefly in hospital after falling ill with the virus. Why is it, do you think, because this is a crisis which has engulfed the whole country, everything ends up being slightly a blind spot. Why do you think this has been, in particular, been a blind spot in the last 12 months, Alice? Why are we only having this conversation now?
I think we knew quite early on that people who had disabilities were being much harder hit by COVID than the rest of the population. And people with learning difficulties in particular, at first it seems strange, but if you talk to GPs, some of them say it's because they find it harder to stick to the restrictions, some of them, because they're not as aware of what they should and shouldn't be doing. Sometimes it's because they have other underlying health conditions. But now we know that they are so much more likely to die from COVID. I think they really should have been put up the list. So the ONS figures that came out last week show that 6 out of 10 people who've died from COVID had some sort of disability. And that those between the age of 18 and 34, it was actually 30 times higher for those with a learning difficulty. And that does seem really extraordinary. It seems that we just sort of failed to understand that. And when Johnson's talking about his roadmap out, I think he sort of forgot the disabled in it. And I think that that is probably a correction they've had to make today, to say we can't leave people behind in this, that we can't expect them to carry on being stuck at home when everyone else is out. There's also other problem, which is the fact that children who are 18 and under, who are have learning disabilities or who are disabled, can't actually get the vaccine yet because we're not vaccinating anyone under 18. So that's a whole nother area where it's very difficult if you have a child who has a disability.
John, it is sort of striking, this, isn't it, that there was a lot of focus, really early on, people who were overweight, and then fairly soon, people from ethnic minority backgrounds and the impact that COVID was having on them. The impact on people who are disabled or have learning disabilities just hasn't been part of that national conversation, is it? Like, that's unfortunately probably a sad reflection of society generally.
Yeah, and that those stats that Alice cited in her column and just repeated now, they're just one of those sort of oh my god moments. I mean, it's incredible. Sort of 6 times more death rate likely to have died if you were disabled. I mean, I just think, and 30 times more in the younger cohorts. I just think it's incredible and terrible. And I feel really divided about this because, I mean, it was brilliant what Jo Wiley did and said, and she did it in a very, her tone was completely right. It was unlike the way some celebrities do it. It wasn't self-aggrandizing. It was really, really just visceral and personal, but in a very calm but also sensitive way. I think she drew attention to it. And think of Marcus Rashford in a different context and free school meals. And what bothers me is not that celebrities draw attention to these important things. It's great that they do, rather than topping up their tans in Dubai and all the other nonsense that they often get up to. But it's why it is that government, public and media are not listening to the quieter voices lobbying for disability or other issues, whether that's the charities or the other groups. I'm sure that they have been trying to get these issues up in lights, but why do we have to only listen when celebrities make the case?
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah, that you're totally right. It's one of those. I suppose it's depressing, and it's probably a reflection of it's not particularly glamorous talking about learning disabilities. And so, you know, and then a celebrity comes along, and that's a way of giving it headlines, which is, yeah, probably says more about us than anything else. So, yeah, just that breaking news in the last few minutes that the JCVI has advised the government at the NHS to invite more than 150,000 people with learning disabilities will be offered the vaccine more quickly than would have been the case. Just finally, I want to talk to you about something that I've written in Times 2 today. John Turode, the Australian TV chef and judge on MasterChef, has said he would never, ever eat his dinner in front of the telly that sofas are for sitting on and not for eating on, which I have written in defence of eating your dinner in front of the telly, because in fact it's the only fun we can have right now. Rachel Johnson, let's be honest, Prime Minister's sister, she's best known for being, she's written a counter-argument, but even she ends up concluding that actually even the Queen eats her dinner off a tray, and so maybe that's also fine. Alice and John, where do you stand on eating your dinner in front of the telly?
Oh, I'm 50-50. I think I kind of vaguely expect everyone to have the first course, so whatever we're having. And then we all kind of go onto the sofa and eat chocolate for the rest of the evening now. It's kind of or it's yogurt that gets dripped everywhere, or ice cream if they can get away with it. But we definitely move, I think, from quite a brief meal to spending the rest of the evening eating chocolates.
Yeah, that's definitely a bit of that. I mean, my baseball is particularly on a Friday night. We've gone full film and a takeaway, only of course to support local businesses, not because we're too lazy to cook.
That's great minds, Matt. So we have we always sit down at the table for six nights a week, and we take it in turns to cook. And partly because we're all doing our own thing, working in the day, and that's the one time. And we also help ourselves at lunchtime. This is in great lockdown mode, which hopefully will come to an end fairly soon. But Friday night is takeaway delivery night, and everybody watching stuff as they eat. And I think that's great. But I think it will all wither away when we're all allowed to go out gallivanting again.
Oh, to go gallivanting. But you know what? Rachel Johnson has just been in touch saying, very huffy you haven't asked me on to talk about TV dinners. I know, Rachel, you are known for other things other than being the Prime Minister's sister. I think she's got a show on another radio station, but, you know, who listens to that, Fanny? Even she's listening to Times Radio. John Campano and Alice Thompson, then, of course, you can read them both online at thetimes.co.uk. Just get yourself a Times digital subscription. Go online, click on something that takes your fancy. And as a bonus right now, you'll get your first month for free. Right, up next is PMQ's Unpacked.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You're listening to the Redbox Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley, and now it's time for this.
PMQs Unpacked on Times Radio. Unpacking the politics and cutting through the crossfire.
Order, order. I call Matt Chorley and Tim Shipman.
Yes, it's that time of the week where we await to see the action in the House of Commons, and PMQ's Unpacked is where we pause the action live so that we can try and explain what is going on. What are they talking about? Who's winning and who's losing? And I'm joined as ever by Tim Shipman, political editor of the Sunday Times. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Matt. I must first apologise for zooming in wearing a jumper, obviously underdressed.
It is. It is very Jonathan Gullis. It has to be said, that jumper you're wearing, the Tory MP who got told off. He wasn't allowed to zoom into the House of Commons. Eleanor Lang sent him away to get dressed properly.
Well, if I'd known, I would have come bare chested like all those Conservative ministers and MPs who were getting their vaccine.
There's a brilliant. We'll see. Boris Johnson supposedly has had his hair cut, according to some, suggesting that Carrie Symons might have done it. It doesn't appear. It doesn't look like he's had it done, judging by the pictures coming out of the House of Commons right now. What do we expect the main issues to be today, Tim?
I mean, looking at those pictures, if that's a haircut, they're obviously charging by the inch because they haven't taken very much off. I mean, you've got several things, haven't you? You've got this whole, you know, it would be strange, wouldn't it, if Keir Starmer didn't try to interrogate Boris Johnson a little bit about his roadmap. You wonder whether the tougher questions will come from the leader of the opposition or from the Tory benches behind him, who are very unhappy about the pace of events. The other big issue is vaccine passports or certificates or apps, or call it what you will. Michael Gove's been put in charge of coming up with something on that. I would imagine the Labour leader might want to try and find out what's going on with that. The government seems to be completely neuralgic about doing this, but seems to recognise that some form of recognition for having had the vaccine is in order. And then, you know, the budget is a week away, and it wouldn't surprise me if you saw Starmer try to sort of roll the pitch a little bit, perhaps try and predict what Rishi Sunak's going to announce in a week and then demand it all now.
Well, let's find out. We go live to the House of Commons. This is the Labour leader, Keir Starmer.
The principles behind the Prime Minister's recovery plan of caution and it must be irreversible are plainly right. But one of the biggest threats to that is misinformation about the risks of the deadly virus. For example, there have been people saying that COVID statistics appear to have been manipulated, that Monday's roadmap is based on dodgy assumptions and false modelling. Does the Prime Minister agree that these kinds of comments are irresponsible and undermine our national recovery?
Prime Minister.
Mr Speaker, the roadmap that we've set out will, I believe, set us on a cautious but irreversible journey to freedom, and I'm glad that he supports the four steps of March the 8th for schools, April 12th for shops, May the 17th for hospitality, June the 21st for everything. And the data supporting all of that, Mr Speaker, has been available to the House since I announced it on Monday.
OK, let's just jump in there. I suspect that the punchline is coming from Keir Starmer, but it's worth pointing out, Tim Shipman, when he talks about people saying that COVID statistics appear to have been manipulated, I think he has one very clear person in mind with that.
Yeah, well, he's talking about the people in the COVID recovery group. Mark Harper, the former chief whip, has been saying this is all a bit dodgy and, you know, what Johnson is relying on bears no resemblance to the reality of what's happening on the ground. The models are all wrong. Steve Baker, his deputy in that group, has been pretty vocal as well. There's been a lot of people sounding off about this. And it's interesting that Starmer's first move is not to disagree with the Prime Minister, but to try and drive a wedge between him and his backbenchers.
Yeah, it was Desmond Swain who famously said that he thought that he was caught saying that the data had been manipulated. Let's see if Keir Starmer is now going to answer his own question. Let's take a listen.
I think the Prime Minister dodged that question, no doubt because all those comments came from his own MPs, some of the 60 or so members of the COVID recovery group. Perhaps the Prime Minister should have a word with them. Another big threat to the recovery plan is that around 3 in 10 people who should be self-isolating aren't doing so. That's a huge gap in our defences. And the small changes on Monday won't fix it. That's why Labour has called for the £500 self-isolation payment to be made available to everybody who needs it. Will the Prime Minister just fix this?
Minister.
Mr Speaker, he knows very well that those who are asked to self-isolate already have the £500 test and trace support payment. And I think he also knows, because he supported the the roadmap on Monday, that the energy he supports the fact the eligibility criteria are being extended to allow parents and guardians to who are staying off work also to receive a payment provided they meet the criteria. I think he's aware of that.
Yes, Tom.
This just have been. I thought that this might be quite a sort of fruitful line of attack from Keir Starmer, but he sort of like banked that sort of clever clogs question of, oh, it's your Tory MPs who are peddling misinformation, and then just sort of moved on to something else.
Yeah, with the not terribly stirring admonition that you perhaps you might just have a word with them. I mean, it's not exactly pouring petrol on a potentially interesting fire. You know, he's made his gambit, I suppose, and there's lots of things he wants to talk about, so he's moved on. But yes, it's less than stirring so far, isn't it?
Okie doke, let's have another one.
Mr. Speaker, 3 out of 10 people who should be self-isolating aren't doing so. That matters to millions of people, and it matters if we're going to get the virus under control. The chair of Test and Trace said that people are scared to come forward for a COVID test because they can't afford to isolate. That's the chair of Test and Take, can't afford it. The government's biosecurity centre concluded that unmet financial need was why some lower income areas are seeing stubbornly high infection rates. So why, after all the billions the government has thrown around, is it still people in low-paid jobs who are at the bottom of this government's priorities?
Yes. Prime Minister.
Actually, Mr. Speaker, I think most people, looking at what we've done throughout this pandemic, looking at the support, the £280 billion package of support, can see that it is the poorest and the neediest in society, those on the lowest income, who have been the top of the government's priorities. And that is quite right. And we will continue to act in that way, Mr. Speaker, and he'll be hearing more about that next week from the Chancellor, in addition to the discretionary funding we've given councils to support those who need it most, including those, Mr. Speaker, who have to self-isolate.
Yes, stop.
Mr. Speaker,
it's interesting, isn't it, Tim Shipman, that the Labour Party obviously wants to paint the government as uncaring and not generous enough and not on the side of the least well-off. But right now, and obviously what happens after the lockdown is another question, when Rishi Sunak presumably tries to claw some of the money back. But right now, they are spending phenomenal amounts of money, increasing universal credit, the furlough scheme, you know, which overwhelmingly you could argue would help those in jobs where they can't work from home, less well-paid jobs in shops and cafes and all that sort of thing. So it's quite a difficult one to hit the government with at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, there's two things here. There's the specific circumstances of COVID, which make it difficult. And as we say week after week, you know, you sit in any focus group, and most people are giving the government the benefit of the doubt for the most part on this stuff. And Boris Johnson there saying, yes, there'll be even more money next week when Rishi Sunak does his budget. The other issue is dealing with Boris Johnson in general. And I remember talking to people who were working for Jeremy Corbyn a year ago who were used to attacking Tory governments from the left and saying they don't spend enough money. And then Boris Johnson was prepared to come in and spend almost limitless amounts of money. And it gives Labour, you know, a very small amount of pitch to play on. And that's something they're still trying to adapt to. And that's, you know, Starmer's challenge over the next 2 or 3 years.
It does also, I know you mentioned the question of, you know, vaccine passports. That's like a big, you know, ideological, ethical question. And it just doesn't feel like this is a Labour Party or a Labour leader who wants to grapple with this. I may be wrong. Let's take a listen. This is Keir Starmer.
Here's the difference. If you need £500 to isolate, you're out of luck. If you've got the Health Secretary's WhatsApp, you get a £1 million contract. Turning to next week's budget. Now, I don't expect the Prime Minister to preempt what's in the budget. If I want that, I can read it on the front page of the Times. But can the Prime Minister at least agree with me today that now is not the time for tax rises for families and for businesses?
Of course, you may have heard me there slightly cheering. Keir Starmer there clearly reading the Times today. Stephen Swinford reporting on the front of the Times that Rishi Sunak is planning to extend the stamp duty holiday. You'll have also read in the Times over the weekend a plan to increase corporation tax. But once again, sort of Keir Starmer struggling a little bit then, because we already are finding out that Rishi Sunak is going to be doing some of the things that otherwise Keir Starmer might be talking about or calling for.
Well, the interesting thing here is that Starmer has spent the last 10 days trying to sell Labour as the new party of business. And he thinks that there is sort of something here that Labour can latch onto. So now the world is turning upside down, and it is the Labour Party saying there shouldn't be any taxes on business. And it's the Conservative Party that's preparing to ramp up corporation tax, as both the Times and Sunday Times have been reporting for some time. And yeah, good to see the leader of the opposition has a good taste in newspapers, if nothing else.
Get yourself a subscription, as ever. Go to thetimes.co.uk. And right now, you'll get your first month for free. Anyway, let's go back to Boris Johnson, see if he's been reading the Times as well.
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I don't know about you, but the budget is happening next week. It's not a date that is concealed from the Right Honourable Gentleman. He knows when it's happening, he knows what to expect. But it's preposterous for him, Mr. Speaker, to talk about tax rises. I mean, he stood on a manifesto only a year ago, Mr. Speaker, or a little over a year ago, to put up taxes by the biggest amount in the history of this country. It is the Labour Party, Mr. Speaker, his Labour Council in Camden, that puts up taxes across the country. That is the way Labour behave, and it's thanks to prudent fiscal management by this government that we've been able to fight this pandemic in the way that we have.
Yes,
I'm not sure the Prime Minister totally knows how things work, about how the Labour Council in Camden is putting up taxes right across the country.
No, I mean, he's playing to the old cliche about the Labour Party, and, you know, hoping that still has some traction, whereas I think a lot of voters will look at Keir Starmer and think that's a little bit different from Jeremy Corbyn. But as I say, these are sort of new and interesting times. I mean, Boris Johnson now talking about prudent fiscal management. That will come as news to the Chancellor of the Exchequer, who's been trying to get him to not commit to quite such extravagant spending for the better part of the last year. But, you know, this is a government that has spent well in excess of £300 billion on this current crisis. And if you've got the Labour Party saying, don't put up tax, there's not been a great deal of pressure on the government to do a great deal about any of this.
It is. It's not just the country that needs to be weaned off this spending. It's the Prime Minister. And that's part of the challenge that the Chancellor is facing. Let's go back to Keir Starmer then. Let's see if he's got an answer to Camden Council's responsibility for all tax.
He wants to talk about tax rises. And he should, because this matters. Councils up and down the country are being forced to decide now whether to put council tax up. That's a £2 billion rise on families. I'm not blaming councils. They've been starved of funding for a decade. And Labour and Conservative councils are in the same position. For example, the Prime Minister might want to concentrate on his own constituency, his own council, Hillingdon. Conservative-run Hillingdon is voting to increase tax, council tax, by 4.8%. Does the Prime Minister think that they're right to do that?
Prime Minister.
I think the Prime Minister just basically just blundered into queuing up the, Keir Starmer's next question there.
They rather quaint that Starmer imagines that Boris Johnson has visited his constituency.
I'm not sure if that counts. I mean, it's not a million miles away from Downing Street. He could pop out there and speak to local people if he wanted to. But council tax, this is a proper bread and butter issue. This is an old school row. Council tax is going up. The opposition blames the government. The government will say, I suspect it's council's fault, not ours.
Council, in common with most Conservative councils, has been running lower taxes, lower council taxes than Labour, up and down the country. He's completely wrong, Mr. Speaker. I'm going to correct him. The top 10 highest council taxing councils in this country are run by the Labour Party, Mr. Speaker. And they are all going to put their taxes up, Mr. Speaker, except for one in those top 10, which is Burnley, which is currently in no overall control, Mr. Speaker. And he talks about London and my own record on taxes. He should talk to the current Labour Mayor of London, who is putting up his council tax by 10%, because I can tell him that the previous Conservative Mayor of London, Mr. Speaker, cut council tax by 20%. That's what Conservative councils do.
Keir Starmer.
Well,
what I was going to say is that he was going going to say that Tory councils cost you less, which of course is exactly what he did. But as you say, this is a good old fashioned row that really appears. It feels so detached from sort of the mainstream of politics to be having a row about council tax that it's actually it's rather sort of quaint and old fashioned. I rather like it.
Yeah, it does. I have seen this ding dong between Jeremy Corbyn and Theresa May, David Cameron and Ed Miliband, David Cameron, Gordon Brown, and Tony Blair before him. Does it make any difference? Do you think? It is one of those things where everyone, you know, you get your bill. I think, oh, that's gone up again. What am I getting for that? You know, the council say, well, the government isn't giving us enough money. Does it have any impact on national politics? Do you think the council tax rises?
I think it does a little bit, but I think it's people are more inclined to blame their local council than to blame the government centrally that isn't giving the council the money it needs. That would be the argument. I think the interesting thing about politics where we are now is that Boris Johnson, if he is successful over the next couple of years, can spend loads of money and get praise for that, whilst also playing a sort of fiscally responsible card and saying the Labour Party would splurge even more. And if he manages to pull off that trick, then that's how the Tories get re-elected. And Starmer's got to try and chivvy away at that.
I suppose the flip side is, if the Tory party is splashing the cash, it makes it much harder for them to say, look at that lot, they want to splash the cash. And the amount of cash we're splashing is fine, but not a penny more is a slightly more difficult dividing line to play. Let's go back then and see how Keir Starmer winds up.
The fact is, Mr. Speaker, that £15 billion has been taken out of council budgets over the last 10 years. The Prime Minister stopped blaming others for the damage he's done, and he quotes the Mayor. He quotes the Mayor. This was the former Mayor who bought water can that couldn't be used, spent millions on a garden bridge that never got built, and then more recently going to pay rose to Dominic Cummings. Mr. Speaker, this is another PMQs with yet again no answers. And the truth is this. The government spent a decade weakening the foundations of our economy and our country. As a result, we have the highest death toll in Europe. We have the worst recession of any major economy. Families are facing council tax rises and millions can't afford to self-isolate. And all the Prime Minister offices are returned to business as usual. Next week's budget is a chance to choose a different path, to build a stronger future, to protect families, to give our key workers the pay rise they deserve and to back British businesses by supporting 100,000 new startups. Will the Prime Minister do so?
Prime Minister.
Now, here's the interesting thing for me, Tim Shipman. He's done this a couple of weeks now. Keir Starmer trying to pin on Boris Johnson the last 10 years of Conservative austerity. And you could say, well, you know, Boris Johnson can argue he wasn't even in Parliament for half of that. He was at least the Foreign Secretary under Theresa May. He was a Conservative mayor. He was very close to David Cameron, at least when he wanted to be. The problem for me, I think, with this as a strategy is he can't say that Boris Johnson was responsible, is culpable for everything that David Cameron did. And yet Keir Starmer has no responsibility at all for Jeremy Corbyn's leadership. And that it does feel like there's a tension there in that strategy.
Yeah, I think there is. And I think what both of them have done relatively successfully is show that they're not, you know, that they are a new broom and that they are a new regime. Starmer certainly pulled that off at the start of his time as Labour leader, I think. And Boris Johnson's success was in saying this is a new government, you know, back in at the end of 2019. And the public broadly bought that. They didn't see Boris Johnson as being very similar. He was pushing Brexit. His predecessors weren't. He's now spending loads of money. His predecessors were nailed to austerity. And it's a difficult argument to make in either direction. That's why I think we're in a pretty new world here. And they're still both finding their feet. And I think this edition of PMQs has shown how difficult it is for them both yet to find the arguments that are going to really, really cut through. I think this has been an interesting sort of probing exercise, but it feels like the world hasn't changed this lunchtime.
Keir Starmer calling for, in the budget next week, a stronger future, protecting families, looking after key workers and backing British business. A radical programme from the Leader of the Opposition. Let's see if Boris Johnson's willing to sign up to it.
Mr. Speaker, if you'll only wait till next week, I think you'll find that we'll do far more than that paltry agenda that he set out. far more than that. And I must say, Mr. Speaker, it is quite mystifying to see the way the Right Honourable Gentleman weaves hither and yon like some sort of druidical rocking stone, Mr. Speaker. One week he claims that he supports the vaccination rollout. The next week he actually attacks the vaccine task force when they're spending money to try to reach hard-to-reach vaccine-resistant groups and says that kind of spending can't be justified. One week he calls for us to go faster with rolling out vaccines, when he would have stayed in the European Medicines Agency, which would have made that rollout impossible, Mr. Speaker. He vacillates, Mr. Speaker, we vaccinate. And we're going to get on, and we're going to get on with our agenda, cautious but irreversibly taking this country forward on a one-way road to freedom. And I very much hope that his support, which has been so evanescent in the past, will genuinely prove irreversible this time, Mr. Speaker.
Well, I don't know about the haircut. Boris Johnson's got a new thesaurus, I think it's fair to say.
I'm Googling the druidical rolling stone as we speak.
I can confirm I am doing the same thing. I'm not quite sure what that means. He weaves hither and thither, no, hither and yon, hither like and a yon. Druidical rocking stone. No idea what all that was about. I mean, he vacillates, we vaccinate. So it's something that probably sounded better in the meeting this morning than it did out in the wild.
Well, it's a decent line if most people know what vacillate means. You know, it works, but it may be regarded as niche. I think it's fair to say.
We'll try and find out more about the druidical rocking stones. This feels like something we need to know about. But I think we can hear now from the leader of the SNP in Westminster. This is Ian Blackford.
The country, and I must say, I wish that the Scottish Nationalist government would spend that money better. Because it's very sad to see some of the failures in education policy in Scotland, the failures in their criminal justice policy in fighting crime. And I think what the people of the whole UK would like to see, and I believe the people of Scotland, is less talk about a referendum, Mr. Speaker, which is his agenda, and more talk about the real issues facing our country.
Yeah. Well, back to Ian Blackford. Ian Blackford.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The Prime Minister's boasting, but the cold, hard reality is that the United Kingdom has suffered the worst slump of any major economy, and 120,000 people have lost their lives. That's under your guidance, Prime Minister. Coronavirus has exposed the deep inequalities under this broken Westminster system. After a decade of Tory cuts, millions of families are in poverty, and UK unemployment is soaring. In contrast, in the United States, President Biden understands what is needed. He has proposed a $1.9 trillion stimulus package to restart and renew the American economy. Prime Minister, will your government follow the example of the US and boost the economy like Biden? Or is the Tory plan to return to type and impose yet another decade of Tory austerity?
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, this government is investing a £640 billion in infrastructure alone throughout the UK. A massive programme to get our country rebuilt and restarted again. And I think that is what people would like to focus on, rather than his agenda to talk about our broken politics, our broken country. All they want to do is break up Britain with another referendum. And I think that is the last thing this country needs at the moment.
More.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Oh, well, there we are. We had a bit of Boris Johnson's response to the first question, then Ian Blackford. They're urging Boris Johnson to be more like Joe Biden, which is actually what Boris Johnson is doing, isn't it?
Yes, I think so. But, I mean, you listen to Ian Blackford and he seems, unlike Starmer, to be sticking with the old themes. It's always Tory cuts, Tory austerity, because the SNP, you know, seem to want to spend more. Johnson, in his answer, doing what he wants his sort of union unit and the people who are supposed to keep this country together are going to be campaigning against the SNP on some of what, you know, Tories would perceive to be their domestic failings. And Johnson is beginning week after week to slip those attacks into his response to Blackford. So you're seeing a sort of bigger picture play out there as well.
The druidical
rocking stone, Matt, is apparently so finely balanced that a small force causes them to rock. So one can understand why dear old Boris Johnson might try to put that on Keir Starmer. It's caused us to resort to Wikipedia, and it's an interesting analogy. He's a very knowledgeable man, the Prime Minister, but again, it does appear to be niche.
It is quite niche. Apparently, there's one down in Cornwall, a rocking stone, a druidical rocking stone, which is said only to move at midnight when witches are out. People claim that if you touch the rocking stone 9 times at midnight, one would turn into a witch. There's one in Yorkshire, which is said to rock only for the efforts of an honest man. Maybe we should take all politicians there and give them a test on that one. There's one in Treen, which is said to cure childhood diseases. And the rocking stone at Land's End was said to have been placed there by a giant who used to use it to rock himself to sleep. There's a slight risk that today's PMQs might have rocked you to sleep as well. I'm not sure we learned a huge amount, but it has sort of shone a light on how politics has changed so much. The pandemic has changed politics. Brexit has changed politics. The both main party leaders are struggling a little bit to adjust to the new world.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. You know, the electoral map has shifted, and some of the alliances that these leaders, the kind of people they attract, has shifted. The reason Boris Johnson was successful in 2019 was because he kind of worked that out before some of the people he was up against. His challenge now is to try and keep that coalition together. The people who are going to attack him are going to have to do it in slightly different ways from how they've done it with the traditional Tory party. Though in Scotland, one suspects the SNP know that it still works to bang on about Tory austerity and wicked Tory cuts. And that's how their politics is slightly differently aligned from how it is in England. It's interesting to see, you know, these different approaches playing out now.
And on that question of Scotland, it's Wednesday now. We must be due another new head of the union unit in Downing Street. You wrote extensively about it at the weekend. What is going on in the on the inside of Number 10? Is the turmoil over? Is it now a happy ship? Who is up? Who is down? Michael Gove was out for about 2 minutes, and now he's back in charge of ethics. It seems of the government operation. What's going on inside Number 10, Tim?
Well, people in there say it's a happier ship. It's sort of less stressful and less heated, but it also seems to be in a mild state of turmoil, where there was sort of the old vote leave crowd against the traditional Boris Johnson people. There now seem to be 4 or 5 different groups. All manoeuvring for position, and the union units got mixed up in that. For those that care about the detail, a chap called Oliver Lewis, who was a vote leave chap who had helped out on the Brexit negotiations, he then went to run the union unit, having ousted a chap called Luke Graham. He's now departed himself, having, you know, by his lights, not been given the support he needed to pursue the strategy he wanted to pursue. And what that will mean in the medium term is that the government's approach to Scotland will be slightly less aggressive, I suspect, than it would have been had Oliver Lewis remained in charge. Michael Gove is now no longer in charge of Brexit, but he's still got, you know, half an eye on what happens with the union. He cares about that stuff. And what they need to do is go and have an argument in Scotland that's not about the constitution, but about lots of other things, which is what you saw Boris Johnson doing at this PMQs as he did last week.
Well, that's it for this episode of Red Box. If you've enjoyed it, don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcast from. Maybe even leave us a rating because it helps with the mumbo jumbo charts. We release an episode every day, Monday to Thursday, featuring the best bit of my Times Radio show. You can listen to the whole thing Monday to Thursday, 10 till 1. It's available on DAB online via smart speaker or on the Times Radio app. If you want to read more about all of the stories we've been discussing, then go to times.radio/subscribe.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.